Good morning to you all. Apologies to Paul and Claire who have to sit through this sermon once again. It's one of the joys of going from two churches on one morning. Question for you this morning is this. Are you driven by your past, your present, or your future? And we talk a lot about that these days. Experiences in the past can very much shape the people that we are. But when we look at this particular passage, it's interesting because you get this sense that Paul wants us to be driven by the future. We all have memories and issues to get through, but he wants us to be driven by the future. And that's what he himself did. He underwent appalling hardships during his travels, but he pressed on because the goal that he believed in lay in the future. And so this morning we're going to be talking about the life to come, the next life, reflecting on what it will be like, but also whether that prospect of being with Christ is the driving factor in our lives. Now, I wonder how you imagine the next life. Christians often talk about the joys of heaven and the fires of hell, but do you imagine it in any more detail than that? I used to get very confused about this because Jesus said there will be no marriage in heaven. That's kind of we're all going to have single beds and it's going to be different. And I had a dream, it may have been a vision actually, but in my dream I saw Trevor and Hazel Kenny. I saw Trevor Kenny. Now I was at the gates of heaven, I was with St. Peter. And there was Trevor, but not with Hazel. With him was this kind of reptilian-looking kind of monster that was just so ugly and drooling and horrible. And I turned to Peter and I said, "What's going on here?" And St. Peter said to me, "Trevor, he used to pull the wings off butterflies." And then in my dream, I saw Mike Turner. And he also was with one of these reptilian horrible-looking creatures, drooling at the mouth and so on. And I turned to St. Peter, almost guessing what the next thing was going to be. And St. Peter said to me, "Yeah, I'm afraid Mike, he used to pull the wings off butterflies." And then I looked a bit further and I saw Peter Earlham. But Peter was with Brenda. And I turned to St. Peter and I said, "What's going on there?" And St. Peter said, "Oh yeah, Brenda, she used to pull the wings off butterflies." Sorry, will you forgive me, brother? Now, the Apostle Paul has spent a long time in chapter 15 talking about the resurrection of Christ and the resurrection of the dead. If there's no resurrection, then what's the point of living a godly life? We may as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And now in these verses 35 to 49, he tries to describe what the life to come is going to be like. Ultimately, he is describing the indescribable. So it's not a detailed picture, but he offers some clues about resurrection bodies. And you can refer to the text back in your leisure, but let me pick out some of the main points I think he makes. The first is that our bodies will be different in verses 35 to 38. And first of all, he makes a parallel with nature, and he contrasts the seed with the plant. Now, we've just got an allotment, so it's going to be interesting. You start putting bulbs in the ground. I never know one bulb from another and what it's going to look like. And there on the screen, you can see that tiny acorn. Who could imagine what a mighty oak tree could grow from that? If you could just take the next slide. Thank you. But do you ever wonder what you might look like in the next life? Now, I hopefully am going to be a little bit different to what I am now. In this life, I'm defined by my very deep sunken eyes, which never look good in photographs, and my bald head. Over the years, people have not recognised me because I'm wearing a hat, and that sometimes plays to my advantage. If I wear a hat and dark glasses, people can say, "Whoa, he's a handsome fella." And then, of course, I take them off and they say, "Oh, my goodness me," you know. Jesus, during the 40 days after his resurrection, makes for a very interesting study, because in some ways he's still the same, but in other ways he's very, very different. He talks to Mary outside the tomb. He cooks fish by the lake. He even eats a meal with his disciples. Thomas is encouraged to touch his crucifixion wounds. But he's also different. He passes through locked doors and vanishes after that walk with two disciples on the road to Emmaus. He's the same Jesus, and yet his body is different. The Gospels are careful with their language. They talk about his post-resurrection appearances, because it's a resurrection. It's not a resuscitation. He's no longer there 24 hours a day, as once been the case. Now he comes and he goes, appearing unpredictably in order to convince his followers that he really is alive. So, in verses 39 to 41, Paul flags up the variety that we see in this life, and I think maybe is suggesting, can you imagine what the variety might look like in the next life? Now, I find this world amazing enough. Take dogs, for example. I mean, I could probably name about a few breeds, but apparently across the world, there are over 360 different breeds of dogs. Take owls. There are over 200 different types of owl. There are 3,000 species of snake. And more depressingly and frighteningly, there are 45,000 different types of spider. Goodness knows how Noah found them all and got them on the ark. And then when you look at people, there's all kinds of different ethnicity as well, isn't there? None of us are pure anything. My son did one of those things that you do online, or blood test or something, or genetic test. I thought he was Anglo-Saxon. He told me he's 70% Viking and is in the process of buying a sword or something to follow through his destiny. Now, all that variety, I get the impression that there will be even more variety in the life to come. Not only will I be different and you be different, but there will be so many textures to what lies beyond. And religious art can be so unimaginative. I tried Googling resurrection bodies and got depressed after about 15 minutes. There was just nothing there that excited me in any way. Maybe our bodies will have new abilities. Did you ever watch the X-Men films years ago? Wolverine, with his ability to heal quickly, and then his adamantium skeleton. Storm, who could control the weather. And I wish you'd done that earlier when I was walking down here, because it was pouring with rain. Just amazing. Wouldn't it be exciting if our bodies actually began to have new powers so that we could show God off to his new creations in the future? No more walking sticks, no more glasses, no more limitations. Instead, a whole host of improvements in our resurrection bodies, plus the prospect of showing God off to his future creations. But the strange thing is that we don't like difference. The history of our human race is about small-minded tribalism and large-scale violence. We seem to prefer people who are like us, rather than broaden our minds by embracing difference. When I was a minister in East London, the majority of my church members had come from Jamaica, some as far back as the very late 40s and early 50s. And they told me their stories, and you know these stories of discrimination and rejection, sometimes even violence. They were good people. They were hardworking people. But they were not well received when they came to this country because they looked different. And if you're not familiar with that, try watching Three Little Birds, which I think is still on BBC iPlayer. I had a church member Her name was Annie. She was in her 60s. She was a white woman. We also had people in the church who were black. And on one occasion when I visited her, she said to me, "Oh, all this immigration is destroying our country, all these black people coming in." And I said to her, "Well, what about Kathleen Thomas?" And she said to me, "Well, I know Kathleen." And I wanted her to kind of follow the logic of that through in her head, you know, that once you get to know people, you begin to see them differently. But sadly, we push people away. We used to have church lunches quite regularly up in London, and people would bring their favourite national dishes. And after the service, we would eat each other's food, acclimatising our palates to an array of amazing flavours. I didn't love all of it, but some of it was great and so different. And it's interesting, that thing about eating. Did you know that the word companion literally means somebody that you eat bread with? Well, we found food was a wonderful way to expand our minds and build bridges with people who were different to us. Unlike us, God loves difference. And it looks like we're going to get even more of it in heaven. So we may as well get used to that now. So firstly, difference. And then secondly, our bodies will be enduring. I hesitate to use the word immortal, although immortal it will be. But I like that word, enduring. Now, in verses 42 to 44, he spells that out for us. Years ago, somebody said to me that when I reach my mid-50s, the rot will begin to set in. At the time, I was 50 years old. I still had a bit of muscle tone and looked a bit mean. But by the age of 55, I was on the slide and developing bingo wings and having to work hard to stay still. Life is kind of cruel like that, isn't it? It takes years for us to stand on our own 2 feet. And then in our mid-20s, we're looking great. And then as we get older, we begin to feel a whole host of chronic pains. Hands up, those who are in pain this morning. See, I have chronic back pain. I can't think of a time when I can't feel that in my back. We used to have a lady in the church who, when we went there, she was 80 years old, and she dropped her keys one day, and we sort of gasped as she went to bend down to pick them up. But she was fine. She picked them up. She's still alive. She's 98 now. She's developed a stage whisper, and she gives a running commentary on how the service is going, which is usually not very well. And the whole church can kind of listen to this stuff. It's kind of embarrassing what potentially we become. It feels like we peak far too early, and then we drift into a long, meandering demise. We accumulate so much experience and wisdom and even responsibility over the years, but then young people see people like me as dinosaurs, out of touch with the real world. Their world doesn't involve cash anymore, or the BBC even, or now Facebook. I mean, that's history, isn't it? And they look at you blankly when you talk in feet and inches rather than centimetres. Oscar Wilde had a point when he wrote that there are only two important things in life, youth and beauty. But, says Paul, the future is mind-blowing. And I apologise for the picture. It was the best thing I could get out of Google. It always has to be a young person, doesn't it? Aging and decay will be history, for our new bodies will be powerful and beautiful and immortal. Just in passing about this, Christians debate whether it will be a level playing field in the next life. Maybe 1 Corinthians 3, 10 to 15 would be an interesting study. Do those who live faithfully and serve diligently get rewarded with more, perhaps bodies with greater capacity? The text isn't explicit, and that debate can wait for another time. And finally, the challenge, therefore, to embrace this future that we have before us. How does it make a difference to us now? Verses 45 to 49, it's hard to kind of wade your way through the wording of Paul there, but I think this might be what he was trying to say. Paul suggests a logical development, the physical first, then the spiritual. The first Adam became a living being, the second Adam, Jesus, a life-giving spirit. Our origins are limited, but our destiny is beyond imagination. Our focus can either be on the familiar now or on what's yet to be, on what is temporary or on what is permanent. Now, it can be hard to work that out. We are physical beings, after all. We live in the now. We all need to eat and drink, to sleep, to wash our bodies and our clothes. If we have children, we've got to attend to their needs. We can't actually drop out of life. But what we can do is to embrace the way of life that Jesus taught us. Love, kindness, gentleness, patience, helping others to experience God's love. And this is the thing that could get lost when you do a sermon like this. We have a responsibility too to see that we're contributing to a better world and that we address the evils that there are in the world around us. And sometimes following Jesus can mean addressing and challenging those evils in the present life that we're living in. Well, thank God for people who did that throughout history. I was reading back through what life was like 200 years ago. And end of the 18th century, you'd seen the French Revolution, and then in the vacuum that was left, Napoleon seized power, and then we had the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. And it all came to an end in 1815 with the Battle of Waterloo. Now, that revolution that had happened in France had its ripples, and people in this country were unsettled. They didn't feel the way that life was, the kind of old feudal system that they had, was good enough, and they wanted to see some changes. And the powers that be feared that there would be a revolution in this country as well. And here's some interesting details. In 1817, well, go back before 1817, did you know that 11% of the male population of this country had the vote? Only 11%. Women didn't have the vote for another 100 years. But only 11% 200 years ago. Then in 1817, there was a petition signed by 750,000 working class people saying that they wanted better representation in Parliament, and it was flatly turned down by the government. 2 years later, in August 1819, and Peter will know this bit of history, 60,000 people gathered in St. Peter's Field in Manchester to protest publicly at their working conditions. The local magistrates overreacted. They sent in the local yeomanry and the 15th Hussars, and swords were flashing. 15 people died, and over 600 were injured. And recalling the Battle of Waterloo 4 years earlier, a local paper dubbed it the Peterloo Massacre. The government's response to this was to tighten the laws against political gatherings. And the whole century that followed was the Tolpuddle Martyrs, the birth of unionism, people like Karl Marx talking about religion being the opiate of the people. What doesn't get remembered, 1817, 1819, but in 1818, the government was keen just to kind of calm things down. So what did they do? They gave £1 million to us, the Church of England, to build 50 new churches. Churches are a lot cheaper in those days, weren't they? But why would they do that? Simply because we're so good at preaching about the joys of the life that's to come that we actually don't do anything about the life that is now. And the church had that tendency to ignore present suffering. Anyway, this contrast between Adam and Jesus is a theme that Paul regularly returns to, whether it's in Romans 5 or Philippians 2. And you can picture it in very simple ways in terms of two gardens. In Eden, the Garden of Eden, Adam, told by the serpent that eating the fruit would make him a god, gladly succumbed to the temptation. In Gethsemane, Jesus, tempted to bypass the way of the cross, resisted resolutely with sweat like great drops of blood. Martin Scorsese, his controversial theme, The Last Temptation of Christ, which got panned by the church as I remember it when it first came out, actually has a very simple message. The temptation of Christ is to just bypass the calling that he has and live an ordinary life. Get married, have kids, get a job, a different kind of job. Don't put up for all of this. And it becomes a powerful temptation, yet ultimately he resists it and treads the way of the cross. So I wonder how much difference any of this will make to me or any of us. A glorious future awaits, but right now we're called to take up our cross, knowing that a better day is coming. Will we choose to be shaped by that glorious destiny that Paul has described? Or will we invest in the temporary things that we see around us now? The story is told about a missionary couple who had gone from America to the continent of Africa to do their work. In the late 1800s, this was, and after 30 or 40 years, they returned at the beginnings of the 1900s. They came by boat across from mainland Africa, across to the Atlantic Ocean, back home again. And when they boarded the boat, they discovered that they were on the same boat as Theodore Roosevelt, the president. He had just been in Africa for a few weeks, shooting elephants and things that don't get good publicity these days. But while the boat was traveling, everybody wanted to make the acquaintance of the president. And he was the show for the day. The missionary couple kind of observed what was going on. And when they arrived back in America, they disembarked, the president, the first one off, to a crowd of journalists wanting to find out how his trip had gone. And the missionary couple just quietly disappeared into the town. And the husband was upset, and he said to his wife, he said, "It just seems unfair. He's just been across to Africa to shoot animals. We've been serving the Lord for 30, 40 years, but when he gets home, there's such a fuss, and when we get home, we get ignored." And the wife said to him, "Look, just go and sit in the other room and think about it and pray about it." And half an hour later, he came out smiling, and she said, "What did God say to you?" And he said, "God said to me, you're not home yet." And I guess that's the Christian life in a nutshell. We work for a better world when we're alive, but ultimately this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. And there may not be accolades in this life for what we do, but ultimately we look forward to being at home in the eternal presence of the Jesus to whom we owe our salvation. And so as we often finish our services, and we might do this twice today, I say to you, go in peace to love and serve the Lord. And you say to me, in the name of Christ, amen. Thank you.